The final investigator I chatted with was Dr. Jeff Oxnard, and to begin, he commented on how the role of specialized tumor tissue assays has evolved in lung cancer over the years.
There was, 10 years ago, a transition towards getting smaller biopsies, being less invasive for our lung cancer patients. And over the more recent 10 years, I think we've learned tissue is more important because there are important questions we can ask with this tissue. That started with the EGFR story. It was kind of an optional piece for a while. People could get away without EGFR mutation testing, even though it's pretty clear the effect of an EGFR inhibitor is profound in an EGFR mutant lung cancer and marginal in EGFR wild-type lung cancer. That became less optional with the introduction of ALK testing, where crizotinib is only indicated in a patient who harbors an ALK alteration. And indeed, the FDA label is specifically for ALK-rearranged non-small cell lung cancer, regardless of line. First line, second line, or third line, have the alteration go to the drug. And so that now means that every oncologist needs to integrate genotyping into their care of lung cancer. And the question becomes, where does that end? You start with EGFR, ALK, where do you go from there? In my practice, the most important next biomarker is KRAS testing. And that's because KRAS is a very common genotype in lung adenocarcinoma. And as such, if you find a KRAS mutation, you stop that quest for their genotype, and you don't spend time, resources, money hunting for the other rare alterations. In my practice, I routinely test EGFR, ALK, KRAS up front. And when I find a KRAS mutation, I don't look for non-overlapping other more rare alterations.
So when you say your practice, what I'm hearing a lot about in academic centers is multiplex testing. And I know you guys have that sort of snapshot thing. So are you using multiplex or specific assays?
The challenge of the multiplex assays is they take weeks rather than days. And so what we have is a rapid assay, rapid allele typing for EGFR, KRAS, and ALK IHC takes about a week, and that gives us the first look at a patient's biology, and we use that to triage where to go next. You're right that most of these patients get confirmatory testing with a multiplexed assay, and indeed, we've just now integrated a multiplexed next-generation sequencing in a clinical laboratory that confirms that rapid test with next-generation sequencing. But, for example, ROS, FISH, and IHC is not very well tested and many multiplexed assays. Often that's going to require ROS FISH with its own individual test, and I'm not going to send that in a patient where I've already found an EGFR, ALK, or KRAS alteration. I think for our lab, a rapid assay in 7 days followed by a multiplex assay that gives us the whole arrangement of a patient's tumor is effective because we have the resources to be able to do next-generation sequencing in-house. For the average clinical oncologist, finding that KRAS mutation up front allows you to say, tell the cancer patient, here's your cancer's biology, and we should focus in on this and not hunt for the rare alleles that might be targetable but might be more elusive.
So we'll talk in a second about exactly who you test, but just to sort of get all the potential tests out there on the table, there are a couple others we've been hearing a lot more about. First, HER2 mutations and particularly BRAF mutations, because there you have the potential consideration of a therapy.
Right. In the patient who's wild type with your first arrangement of testing, maybe the triple negative lung cancer, you might argue, that person, I focus next on ROS FISH, which is targetable based on a phase one experience of a high response rate, phase 1-2, and BRAF V600E testing, which is targetable based on a moderately high response rate seen in a reported phase 2 trial. Those two are the known targetable alterations. There are other oncogenes that are important. Those include HER2 insertions, which to date, it's not quite as clear how targetable they are. We're still trying to find the regimen that gives a big punch to that population. EGFR exon 20 insertions. Let's remember there are a subset of EGFR mutations that are potentially targetable, that are oncogenic, that are a non-overlapping genotype-defined population, but don't yet have a clear drug for them. And then even less common, MET amplification. In those rare patients with amplification on FISH, you can see gangbusters response with crizotinib. And lastly, RET rearrangement, which is very rare, trying to find the right drug for these patients. But at least those alterations can feed you towards important clinical trials.
Is there a TKI right now? Because there are a couple that are actually, I think, available, theoretically, could use that targets RET.
There are quite a range. They are all relatively dirty TKIs. They are multi-kinase inhibitors. Vandetanib has some RET effect. Sunitinib has some RET effect. Sorafenib has some RET effect. All of those are drugs that have been well studied in lung cancer, and some subset of patients respond. They all, though, have their associated toxicities, their VEGF inhibitors, etc. The perhaps more potent RET inhibitors are going to be cabozantinib, which has some reported experience in a small case series, some nice responses seen, but is also less well studied in lung cancer and has its toxicities. I think if you find a RET rearrangement, aim for a trial if you can so we can learn about which drugs really work.
What about BRAF first in terms of the V600E mutation that you mentioned? Do you think it is reasonable to consider or attempt to obtain one of the available approved BRAF inhibitors?
I think it's reasonable. The drugs have very real toxicity, so you need to be familiar with using them because they can cause real cutaneous toxicity. We've seen real responses that may not be as durable as the responses with crizotinib or erlotinib. I think it's an option. The question is, in that patient who's a relatively heavy smoker with adenocarcinoma, are you going to go hunting for the V600D that's present in about 1% of cases? Certainly, if you find it in multiplex testing, I think it's appropriate to try to integrate one of those drugs into your second or third line care as available drugs start to wane in their efficacy. And sometimes insurance companies will cover it. And indeed, the NCCN guidelines are now listing that it's appropriate to consider these drugs for V600E mutant non-small cell lung cancer. And that's vemurafenib, or dabrafenib is in fact the best studied in lung cancer.
Of course, that also maybe would open up the possibility of participation in a trial. But I understand also that at least in lung cancer, there are other BRAF mutations and there's another potential path to follow to target these. What's the deal there?
Non-V600E mutations are found more commonly in smokers, are found, in fact, more commonly in squamous cell carcinoma as well. It's a separate family, I think. I'm not convinced they're going to be as targetable as V600E mutations. I, in fact, lump them in my thinking somewhat like PI3 kinase mutations, which may affect the biology of the cancer, but may not be oncogenic drivers in the same way as V600E or HER2 mutations. And there, you know, I would not give off-label, integrate into your practice a BRAF inhibitor, one of those patients. Those people need to be studied, and those trials are under development. For example, MEK inhibitors for non-V600E BRAF mutations are an area of investigation.
One more question about BRAF inhibitors. You referred to, you know, if you had a patient who was a smoker with an adenocarcinoma, but I was under the impression that BRAF was irrespective of smoking status.
In some subset analyses, when you dig a little bit deeper, the V600D, the more targetable one, is a little more enriched in the non-smokers. And the non-targetable, or less targetable perhaps, non-V600E mutations are more enriched in smokers. There are small studies that's still being clarified, but that's my impression of the data.
So, you know, this is all, you know, fascinating. And I guess for people who don't specialize in lung cancer, as you mentioned, they're pretty uncommon, some of these mutations. But certainly EGFR mutations and ALK rearrangements are, you know, not that rare. And I guess the question that's been debated, and I see changing it, it seems like, in people's mind, is when do you test, at least for EGFR and ALK? What's your algorithm?
Not only are they not that rare, but they're increasingly common because these patients are living three times as long as our other lung cancer patients. And so they're accumulating in our practice as they keep showing up. And I think that should leave the message that these drugs are really disease modifying and we need to get them into our patients as early as possible. I routinely genotype when I first meet a patient with advanced lung adenocarcinoma or any non-squamous, non-small cell lung cancer, excluding a carcinoid, for example. And I test up front. I try to get results back within 1 or 2 weeks so I can use that to make my first decision. I will admit that sometimes that gets more complicated. The tissue you're trying to use is in another hospital. The patient has inadequate tissue, need a new biopsy, and it's becoming clear that sometimes that turnaround time takes a little bit longer and it gets more complicated to get that answer. If the patient can wait, if you're getting whole brain radiation, if you are optimizing their symptom management before starting therapy, use that time to get genotype. Sometimes the patient can't wait, I'll admit. Sometimes the patient has an overwhelming tumor burden and you need to pull the trigger quickly. And in those patients, I will start chemotherapy and defer the question of genotyping until the results available, maybe after a couple cycles, maybe after an induction phase of treatment.
So you have what I would call sort of a breast cancer ER-HER2 approach to adenocarcinoma, which means when you get tissue, you test it. I should add too, does that include, say, resected surgical specimens?
For me, it's about the chance of recurrence. When you get to stage 2, stage 3 non-small cell lung cancer, you know, most of these patients are recurring. Most of these patients need this result. And I don't want to wait till they recur and then go to the refrigerator and try to find that tumor and work it out then. We need to have that result available to make often a really urgent decision about treatment. I think it's definitely defensible for a stage 2 or 3 to be genotyping reflexively. Stage 1s, one can argue the chance of them being cured is greater than the chance of them being not cured. And so maybe stage 1s, I don't genotype as routinely.
What about squamous cell?
A pure squamous on a resection specimen where the pathologist is like, look, that's a squamous, I know it, I will not genotype. In a more borderline case, poorly differentiated, it's TTF1 negative, they're favoring squamous, I might genotype that because the truth is histology is sometimes wrong, and sometimes those are actually adenocarcinomas underneath. Certainly in a never smoker or in a light smoker, I'm always genotyping because the chances are that's an adenocarcinoma.
And again, the metastatic disease, same thing?
For squamous, yeah, metastatic disease. A resected squam, I don't think the chances of finding something meaningful on EGFR ALK testing is worth the resources invested.
So let's go a little bit more into targeted therapy with that sort of by way of background. And I think that your cases could really allow us to do that. So why don't we start out with your 55-year-old man?
So this is an individual who has been doing great on first-line erlotinib for months now. We see these patients all the time, and they develop that first sign of progression. In this patient, his mnemonic mass in the left lower lobe had a great response. And when he develops progression, it's actually a new lesion along the left pleura.
So can we just go back to when he was first diagnosed?
Yeah.
This was 8 months ago?
Yeah.
Because actually, I mean, I know that there's a very, you know, all three of these cases are very interesting points, but I also would like to use it as a way to get into some basic stuff.
Great.
So let's just do this. You saw him when he was first diagnosed?
I did not. He saw a colleague of mine.
Okay. So are you seeing him now? Is he your patient?
He's passed, but I picked up his care along
the way. I see. Okay. All right. So maybe you can just kind of talk about the way he presented.
Right. He presented with a lung mass and a pleural effusion. Classic stage 4 lung cancer, perhaps more limited. What's nice about a pleural effusion is that it is a fairly attainable tissue for testing. I routinely drain pleural effusions, often with Pleurix catheters, and I use that intervention both to make the patient symptomatically better. He had dyspnea and cough from the effusion, and also I saved that effusion for genetic testing.
Was he a smoker?
He was a non-smoker. Asian, never smoker.
So you get back his tissue and he's got adenocarcinoma. What kind of EGFR mutation?
He had an L858R mutation.
Just to kind of, you mentioned before the exon 20 mutation. What do we know right now about the different types of EGFR mutations and whether or not they respond to TKIs?
Great point. The most common two types are exon 19 deletions and L858R, very well studied. These drugs respond to a variety of TKIs. First generation reversible TKIs, second generation irreversible TKIs like afatinib as well, and can gain durable response. I think no question in my mind, patient like this newly presents, finding one of these common EGFR mutations, you reach for an EGFR TKI. The second most common family of these mutations is in fact the EGFR exon 20 insertions, which occur probably in 3,000 US patients a year. I mean, as common as mesothelioma, and yet we sort of don't find them that often, and we don't know how to treat them, and they blend in with the rest. Those patients, EGFR exon 20 insertions, I do not use EGFR TKI first line. I think about it second or third line, though the chance of response is quite small. The next family of EGFR mutations is G719X and L861Q mutations in exon 18 and exon 21. They represent 1-2% of EGFR mutant lung cancers. And you will definitely see these in your practice. They're more commonly combined with other mutations, which leads to a slightly more confusing picture. There are a couple of series that have been reported now on response to EGFR inhibitors. Some of these are larger series, some of these are smaller, and the story's a little bit mixed. I think their chance of responding to an EGFR TKI is more in the range of 40% or 50%, not as likely as the 60 or 70% chance of responding to the common EGFR mutations. There's some more recent literature with afatinib showing some pretty compelling response data that was part of their prospective Lux Lung series, and so I like that it was part of a prospective trial. I don't know that we know that afatinib is more effective than erlotinib or gefitinib for these patients, but perhaps if I'm going to do a first-line EGFR inhibitor for a G719X for a patient who wants to go for EGFR inhibitor and not chemotherapy first-line, I do think I'd reach for afatinib. It has more potency against wild type and potentially more potency against these EGFR mutations based on some preclinical data. Overall, the picture is a little bit murky, and I think if the patient's not a gambler, I think the standard of care for these rare mutations is chemotherapy first line and save TKI as a maintenance or second line therapy.
You mentioned something I haven't heard before. Did you say that afatinib is more effective against wild type?
Afatinib has activity against wild-type EGFR and against HER2 based on preclinical models, suggesting it has broader effects. And indeed, that potency against wild-type EGFR and that potency against HER2 leads to some of the toxicity that we see. Erlotinib is dosed in such a way that it has some of that wild-type activity. Gefitinib is dosed at a lower dose with less of that wild-type activity. You know, we're really trying to piece together preclinical data and clinical data to make these decisions. And based on the broader activity of afatinib against a couple of targets, I think it's reasonable to use it in these rare populations where you want the drug with the most punch.
It's interesting. This man ended up receiving erlotinib. I'm not even sure if afatinib was approved.
True, that was a few years ago.
So I am curious right now how you're approaching the choice of TKI now that we have two available.
Right. I present it to most patients. I will say that there are some patients where I'm more comfortable using erlotinib, an older, more delicate patient where I'm not even going to start at full dose, where I start at a lower dose erlotinib, like 100 milligrams, because in my experience, I know that can be effective. Those are patients where I'll use erlotinib. In patients where maybe I'm going to be starting with brain radiation and want to add the EGFR TKI, as has been shown to be safe in some phase 2 trials, I'll be using erlotinib. And the patient who doesn't need some outside-the-box effect, I'm going to present erlotinib and afatinib to them. Afatinib can have a slightly different spectrum of toxicities with paronychia and mucositis, a little bit more diarrhea. And so I present it to a patient. I think patients who want to be really aggressive, who are comfortable with the potential for greater toxicity, they will sometimes say, I'm interested in afatinib because I want to get the chance of that extra effect. Erlotinib, I think we have a lot of experience with, I'm very comfortable with, and there's no clear data showing that afatinib versus erlotinib, one's better or not. A lot of patients who want the opportunity to have lower toxicity and want a safer bet might go erlotinib. I will point out that I have patients on afatinib a year in who feel great, who have no side effects. And the fact is most of the side effects are in the first few months, and after you adapt to it and get through it, it becomes more tolerable. So it's not really that clear that afatinib has a big degree of toxicity difference over erlotinib, but it's also not clear that second generation EGFR TKIs have a therapeutic benefit over first generation EGFR TKIs. That needs to be studied, and those randomized trials are underway.
So this man, as you say, sort of began out following a typical course of having a nice objective response, and symptomatically, did he improve?
Yes, dyspnea got better. In fact, most of his disease vanished.
And then what happened?
He developed a progression. We call this acquired resistance, and his particular type of acquired resistance was a new pleural-based metastasis. When I think about acquired resistance, there are different phenotypes when we see it. Patients can feel worse or feel better. The existing disease can grow back, or you can get a new disease. In his case, he had a new metastasis, which to me is a sign of a slightly more aggressive characteristic. And in his case, we biopsied him as part of a clinical trial, and that biopsy of the new pleural-based mass showed small cell transformation, which is uncommon, but something that you see when you sometimes exhibit a more aggressive resistance to the drug.
How common or uncommon is it?
Depending on the series, I think we see it in 3% to 10% of cases. I would say around 5%, 1 in 20. The more biopsies you do, the more you stumble upon it every so often.
And I don't know, you know, whether or not we know enough about this, but usually does it sort of behave like small cell and stay that way?
I think it can show up in surprising times sometimes. It's not only in cases with overwhelming progression. Sometimes I had a patient who developed resistance in a new adrenal mass. I was a little bit surprised when I found the small cell transformation. We don't know a lot about its biology. It can respond to platinum and etoposide chemotherapy based on a small published experience, and therefore that is what I routinely use when I do see it. I think the risk is it's going to behave like small cell, and so you need to be aggressive with a small cell regimen. I certainly wouldn't put one of these patients on a clinical trial of a targeted therapy. I mean, these are patients where you should throw the book at them and try to get their disease under control.
And is this any more common in patients with mutations?
We've only seen it in patients with EGFR mutations developing resistance to EGFR TKI, I think because those are the people that we're re-biopsying. It's not like we re-biopsy patients when they develop resistance to pemetrexed to see if they developed small cell transformation. And so there's not a lot of experience in this. It's a reasonable question. If we did more biopsies, would we see this more commonly?
Or do you see it in autopsies?
I do not think we see it routinely in advanced adenocarcinoma autopsies.
So at that point, what happened? You treated him for small cell?
Yes. We started EP chemotherapy. He had a nice response in this pleural-based metastasis. At the first reimaging, I was surprised to see that while that new mass had shrunk, the prior lower lobe mass had regrown. I mean, it was very striking. One area shrinks down, one area grows back. And this would normally be called a mixed response to us. It would make me worried that the chemo wasn't working. But when I looked back over prior imaging and saw that this new mass was in fact his original mass just regrowing, it seemed to me that this was a sign that there are cells in there that are still sensitive to the erlotinib that we had stopped when we switched to chemotherapy. And so in fact, I then added erlotinib to chemotherapy for the next two cycles. And at the next scan, that pleural-based mass had shrunk further, the original mass had vanished again. And to me, it exhibited the diversity and heterogeneity of acquired resistance, that there can still be some cells sensitive to your original drug and some cells resistant. And this supports my practice where often when I start chemotherapy for patients like this, I will continue the original EGFR TKI, often at a lower dose, in order to control these two populations.
And of course, that's very controversial. There are a bunch of people who don't do that. But, you know, just looking at this case, it's kind of like almost following like a urinary tract infection, you know, super infection and whatever, you know, the microbial concept of cancer progression, although rarely does it look as straightforward as it does in this case.
This is a pretty straightforward case, which is why I highlighted. I think that the model in oncology I would reference is in prostate cancer, where we never reverse GnRH agonists. We always continue to loop on, understanding that hormone therapy remains an important component of the prostate cancer care, and we add to that our subsequent targeted therapies or chemotherapies. I think that's a possible model for EGFR mutant lung cancer. I'll point out that when they transform to small cell, they still have that EGFR mutation. That underlying biology doesn't vanish. It's still there with new biology added atop.
Really?
Definitely.
You have small cell with EGFR mutations?
This is a never smoker who's developed a transformation into small cell despite an underlying EGFR mutation.
Wow. But yet not responsive to a TKI. So I guess I'm trying to figure out which clone sort of took over next.
We're trying to understand that ourselves, and we have some preclinical research underway.
What happened with him?
He responded for a period. He developed resistance again. In fact, a later biopsy did not show small cell. I don't know if the small cell went away, and he went on to a clinical trial. He actually had a pretty rocky course after this. He's not one of these patients with acquired resistance who can hang on for months and months, years and years. And unfortunately, he passed away after another line of chemotherapy after this.
And the case also brings up the common question about patients who develop resistance or clinical resistance on a TKI, and you talked about the idea of keeping the TKI going and then adding in chemotherapy. We were talking before about afatinib, and I'm curious what your thoughts are about the afatinib-cetuximab combination and where that might be heading, because it's at least the initial report we saw a couple years ago looked pretty encouraging.
Right. Because none of us like chemotherapy that much, all of us are looking for ways to use smarter drugs, smarter targeted therapies, reference prostate cancer. Like we have all these great new hormonal therapies in prostate cancer, why can't we do that in EGFR mutant lung cancer and instead delay chemotherapy by getting some potent EGFR-directed therapy? To date, the most potent EGFR-directed regimen has been this combination of afatinib, an irreversible EGFR kinase inhibitor, with cetuximab, an antibody to EGFR, which somehow clears the mutant EGFR protein from the cell, depletes it of EGFR, and leads to these responses. I think the responses were in the range of 40% range, which is pretty great compared to all the clinical trials we've been doing here.
And the waterfall plot looked pretty good.
And the waterfall plot looked
like
pretty good.
Like even more, yeah.
The challenge we've seen is some toxicity. We talked about the fact that afatinib can have some increased toxicity for some patients over erlotinib. Cetuximab has its own spectrum of toxicities, indeed, where more rash may mean more effect with that drug. And so when you add afatinib to cetuximab, it comes with a significant component of EGFR-directed toxicity. Patients are sometimes up for that if they really need a response. The question becomes, is that kind of a combination better than or worse than giving carboplatin plus pemetrexed, a regimen that we're all fairly familiar with and has some pretty reliable effect itself? And that's what we don't know. I think if your patient's been on afatinib and they become comfortable with it and they're used to the toxicity, an intuitive next step would be to try adding cetuximab and see if that regains a response. If your patient's been on erlotinib and you're transitioning to afatinib plus cetuximab, that might be a bigger change in potential toxicity spectrum for a patient. It's a compelling rationale, it's a compelling approach, and it needs to be studied.
So the final thing I want to ask you about is you were mentioning earlier about the issue of EGFR wild-type disease, afatinib's effect, et cetera. And I'm curious what your take is in terms of EGFR TKIs, at least the current ones that we have in wild-type disease. What are your thoughts about what role they should play, if any? And I'm also curious what your thoughts are about the VIRASTRAT trial that looked at an attempt to try to figure out what to do with these patients using a proteomic serum assay.
Right. EGFR mutation testing is clearly an important biomarker, and it distinguishes two populations of patients, a patient who gets a huge effect from an EGFR TKI and a patient who gets a more marginal effect. It's not feasible for everyone, I'll point out, and it's not always accurate either. EGFR wild-type cancers represent a genetically diffuse group. Some of them have KRAS mutations. Trust me, I never give an EGFR TKI to a KRAS mutant lung cancer. It's just a different biology. Some of them have ALK rearrangements. And some of them end up being really wild type. And I will say that even in one of those patients, after four lines of chemotherapy, we do a new biopsy, we send it for next generation sequencing, and guess what it found? An EGFR mutation that was missed in the original testing. The fact is that testing can be wrong sometimes, and I think it's appropriate at some point in a patient's care to get a trial of an EGFR TKI. But it's not very early in their care. And when I have other agents available, such as second line docetaxel, I prefer second-line docetaxel for an EGFR wild-type cancer. But I'm willing to discuss it in the third line, where, mind you, it is FDA-approved to give erlotinib, but I'll discuss it in the context of supportive care, of clinical trials, or perhaps trying this drug that has a chance of giving you some benefit, perhaps dramatic, but unlikely if you have no EGFR mutation. The PROSE study of the VIRASTRAT assay looked in the second-line space at trying to differentiate who can gain more versus less from erlotinib versus docetaxel. In these EGFR wild-type patients, the fact is across the whole study, most patients gain more from docetaxel. But in the VIRASTRAT good group, it looked like the two were a little more of a wash, and therefore it was an opportunity to try erlotinib over docetaxel. I do not use this in my practice. I think it's easier to reach for the docetaxel, which I think is more reliably going to be effective in a patient who's EGFR wild type. And I save the oral therapy for a later line when I've really exhausted all of my options.
Just out of curiosity, do you think there's some basic flaw in the way the PROSE trial was done? Or I don't know. You know, to me, you know, sort of if you believe, I mean, it was a randomized phase three, which I thought was amazing for a predictive test. But, you know, it looked like you kind of in those, like you say, in the good patients, so to speak, they seem to do as well with erlotinib as docetaxel. It seems like at least that would present an option.
No, I think it presents an option. The question is integrating this test into our standard care, and hasn't integrated into my care. I guess it's much like with KRAS negative selection for cetuximab in colon cancer. Do we prefer a negative selection versus a positive selection assay? I like EGFR mutation testing because it tells me where to go. It answers the question for me. Negative selection, which is how the VIRASTRAT assay would be integrated into this second line care, doesn't really tell us where to go and which is better. It instead says, in this population, which is VIRASTRAT negative, go to docetaxel. In this population that's VeriStrat positive, it's still a wash, it's still a balance, and you get to decide. I think that means that across a broader population of patients, docetaxel is more likely to be effective. I won't deny that some patients are looking for an excuse to miss IV chemotherapy and reach for an oral drug. And if that patient is really pushing you and says, I want to really find a way to avoid IV chemotherapy, this could be used. But I wouldn't use it over, for example, KRAS mutation testing, which to me is more reliable.
So a couple other questions. There's a press release out there saying that there's a positive study of the drug ramucirumab, an anti-VEGFR monoclonal antibody that we've been hearing a lot about in gastric cancer. Do you know anything about that?
Yes. Not a lot. I'm a lung cancer specialist, but I at least heard that press release. And I think VEGF continues to be around. It continues to not go away, even though bevacizumab has been approved in lung, colon, and breast cancer, renal cell cancer, and then had it removed in breast cancer. It's a little bit of a struggle, I think, with VEGF. We've now got multiple VEGF drugs in renal cell cancer, multiple VEGF drugs in colon cancer, and now bevacizumab just prolongs survival in cervical cancer, and ramucirumab, a new VEGF inhibitor, prolonging survival in gastric cancer. I think it highlights to us that VEGF continues to be an important pathway to target and integrate with chemotherapy, though we still don't have a biomarker to tell us which patients should or shouldn't get this. To me, it's reminiscent of the nintedanib data in lung cancer, where nintedanib added to docetaxel has had a PFS effect, second-line non-small cell lung cancer, again, a VEGF inhibitor, to point out that VEGF isn't gone. I think that the magnitude of benefit is somewhat smaller compared to the huge responses we see with erlotinib or crizotinib in the right selected patients. What I still hope we can do is find a population who should get these drugs and help us amplify that hazard ratio, and so we're getting a real, more dramatic effect and not a more marginal effect.
It is interesting, though, to think about, like, maybe a year from now, you know, people are going to be using ramucirumab probably for gastric cancer, maybe lung cancer. It may be a common drug to be used.
I won't deny. It's an active drug. The question becomes, of all the VEGF agents, how do you build it into your care, and which one do you use? You know, I think the best example of that is second-line colorectal cancer, where now you have VEGF trap versus bevacizumab both available. And so now we're both picking between different chemotherapies and different VEGF therapies. The menu is becoming more and more confusing.
Yeah, that's a topic that your colleague Charlie Fuchs has addressed more than once in some of our programs. Final question I'm going to ask you. We haven't talked too much about squamous cell. Again, Dr. Gandara went into a lot of that. But I just got back the results from a survey we did on 100 oncologists, and I found one of the results very interesting. I'm just going to throw out to you, sort of hot off the press, which was their first-line therapy for metastatic squamous cell. So I'm curious what you use and what you would predict we saw.
The drugs we're familiar with, the drug that has been around for the longest time, is carboplatin plus paclitaxel. I will say we should note that carboplatin plus paclitaxel is not even FDA approved for squamous cell lung cancer and is off-label usage. The approved regimen is probably cisplatin plus gemcitabine, and in a young, motivated patient, that's what I use the most. But in a patient who's not a cisplatin candidate, and that's fairly common in squamous cell lung cancer, I more commonly use carboplatin plus paclitaxel. The new drug that's emerging is the new paclitaxel, which is nab-paclitaxel. I will point out that was approved based on response rate in a phase 3 trial where nab-paclitaxel had a better response rate than carboplatin plus paclitaxel. Some are scratching their heads as to why it was a response rate trial, not a PFS or overall survival trial, and that's because it used a specific development path where they said, we took an existing technology, paclitaxel, we're building upon that technology and making it better, and therefore the evidentiary requirement is slightly lower. All right. And that was a very pre-specified agreement between the FDA and the company, and they nailed that. And the fact is response rates were better with nab-paclitaxel. I will say that carboplatin-paclitaxel is every 3 weeks, which patients like. Carboplatin plus nab-paclitaxel is a weekly regimen, which has some other differences. The fact is they have different toxicity profiles. Paclitaxel every 3 weeks needs more steroids. Nab-paclitaxel, less steroids.
Less or none.
Or none, exactly. And this is the conversation I have with patients with squamous cell lung cancer when I pick a regimen. My guess is from your survey that nab-paclitaxel is becoming quite adopted because it has a greater chance of response, is because it doesn't need the steroids, easier on the kidneys. There are different rules. I am using either one depending on the patient, depending on what they need for my treatment.
You said cis-gem. Do you not use carbo-gem?
I prefer CIS-GEM. I think combining carboplatin plus gemcitabine is a little tougher on the bone marrow. Gemcitabine certainly has more of a bone marrow effect than paclitaxel, and I've been burned a couple times with patients getting really low blood counts when you combine carbo with gemcitabine.
So what we saw, and it kind of surprised me, was it was almost really a third, roughly, of carbo with either paclitaxel, gem, or as you said, NAB. I was kind of surprised about the NAB because I haven't seen that much interest in the investigators. Of course, the docs in practice had NAB out there in breast cancer for a while, and for whatever reason, that's what we saw. And I imagine, as you said, it really just gets individualized.
I agree with you. And I think it's nice that we have these different options for patients. I mean, that's great to be able to have this conversation. Given how interesting the care is for adenocarcinoma, it's kind of become a little bit stale in squamous cell carcinoma. And so, yeah, we want to have a menu to be able to present to patients. It would be nice to be able to know which of these is best. In the end, the pressures that are being pushed on us are increasingly being cost and toxicity. And so I think some guidelines may end up steering us one way or another on that.
Well, like a lot of oncologists, I'm always thinking to myself, what would I do if it were me? I think I'd be looking for a trial of anti-PD-1.
I completely agree with you. To me, the most compelling space is, in fact, going to be maintenance. Patients been on chemo for 4-6 cycles. They're doing great. And they're like, doc, you're really just dropping the ball on me, and that's it? What we need is a place to fill there to delay recurrence, prolong survival. And so I can't wait to use a PD-1 drug in the maintenance space to try to consolidate that response.
Well, you know, one other thing we saw in the survey, incidentally, was that, and I just started kind of, I started actually hearing this from investigators, which I wasn't even aware of, which is use of maintenance in squamous cell. And it's not that common. I think in our survey in the oncologists, it was, you know, uncommon. I think maybe a quarter of people use different kinds of maintenance. But I've heard a few investigators say they do it. What are your thoughts about that?
The reason the whole maintenance question comes up is that patients are not uncommonly a little bit burned after 4-6 cycles of standard chemotherapy. Pemetrexed sort of doesn't have that cumulative toxicity, and therefore it's easier to do it longer. But a lot of patients are pretty worn out after 4-6 cycles of platinum doublet for a squam. And so sometimes it's a non-question. You know, when I say, guess what, there's switch maintenance data with docetaxel, they roll their eyes and they say, look, I'm going on vacation, call me in a few months. Their erlotinib question, I think the hazard ratio of effect, the degree of benefit with erlotinib in squamous cell lung cancers is pretty marginal. I won't deny there are some patients who are feeling great after chemotherapy and they want to do something, and therefore there is data to support doing erlotinib. What we all want is a drug that's going to be less toxic and therefore easier to give in this space where patients are a little more beat up and more effective. And I think that's an intuitive space for PD-1 to be more effective over the marginally active erlotinib and more toxic docetaxel.
What about a taxane as maintenance?
That's been studied in various places. It's also been looked at in ovarian cancer. The fact is, people are beat up with paclitaxel. Their nerves are pretty injured. I think it's a reasonable question as to whether NAB paclitaxel could be continued. But even then, patients have cumulative fatigue, skin toxicity. And so I find most of my patients are looking for a break. They're looking for an excuse for me to say, it's okay for you now to take a break, and we can pick this up again when we need it.